From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. The great Aretha Franklin passed away early this morning. We remember her in music and words throughout the entire first hour of Air Talk on KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The Queen of Soul has passed. Aretha Franklin died this morning of pancreatic cancer in Detroit at the age of 76. If you came up in the 60s and 70s as I did, you probably feel a lot like me. We've lost someone who created an extraordinary sound that takes us back to the formative years of our lives. She's not only arguably the greatest popular singer America's ever produced, she's one of our most influential. I had the honor of interviewing Miss Franklin back in 2009. In advance of her performance at the Hollywood Bowl, I opened the interview playing the song we're hearing now and asked her what she felt listening to her classic recordings.
They sound wonderful. Just to hear those things that I recorded back in 66, 67, they just sound wonderful. And as my producer used to say, Jerry Wexler, do they stand up the morning after the session? Are they standing the test of time? And I think that they are.
I also asked Miss Franklin about her musical influences, and one of those had a deep presence in L.A.
Coming up, one of my major and main influences was Clara Ward of the world-famous Clara Ward Gospel Singers out of Philadelphia, and they traveled nationally and internationally, and they were a big, big name in Las Vegas way back in the day. And, of course, Reverend James Cleveland, who had a church right there in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And Reverend Cleveland at one time was the choir director for our church.
Oh.
And but I was very highly influenced by his piano stylings. And really loved and enjoyed him as an artist and singer as well.
She did an extraordinary double album, Amazing Grace. We'll hear a track off that a little bit later with Reverend James Cleveland and his gospel choir. By the way, Clara Ward, the great gospel singer, used to visit the Franklin household. Aretha Franklin's father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, a huge figure, not just in Detroit where he pastored the family church, but in traveling the country, preaching at churches across the U.S., and then later managing his daughter, Aretha Franklin. That full interview with Aretha Franklin you can find on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. But I'm very pleased to have with us a gentleman who wrote two biographies on Aretha Franklin, Respect, The Life of Aretha Franklin, out 4 years ago, and co-author of Aretha From These Roots in 1999. David Ritz, it's good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
I appreciate your having me on.
David, obviously, today is a difficult day, but what a chance to hear the incredible music that she produced over the course of her career. On the first biography, you worked on that with her, is that right?
I did.
And what was that experience like writing with her?
It was challenging. You know, it was great. It was, you know, when I got the gig, I was jumping up and down. I mean, I had been chasing after her for years and years and years to help her do her book. And spent a lot of time in the kitchen, and she likes to cook, and I like to eat. And so we had a good time. When it came to the text, there was a whole bunch of different challenges for me, her version of her life was her own, and you know, I kind of felt she was entitled to it. But when the book was done, I felt like there was a different story there, and so I think I waited 13 or 14 years before I made up my mind to do my own book about her. And so these two books are there. I think her book is important because if you really want to understand who she, if you want to understand how she looked at herself, you definitely want to read her book. And if you want to see a different point of view from other people, her brother, their sisters, her producers, then those points of view are in my own book. But in any event, the bottom line is he was an enormously complicated person. I believe with all my heart that she was a genius. I think genius is a very hard thing to negotiate. And yet over 60 years, she was able to create some of the greatest music in our culture. And I am absolutely certain that that music will be there forever.
We're talking with David Ritz, who's written two biographies of Aretha Franklin, an authorized version with Aretha, published back in 1999, and then the book that came out 4 years ago, which he just described, which got deeper into some of the aspects of Aretha Franklin's life she didn't either see that way or didn't want included in the authorized autobiography. The book David wrote titled Respect, The Life of Aretha Franklin. Before we get into the gospel early years and the influences of her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, I want to go back to that Amazing Grace, that live gospel album song, How I Got Over, Aretha Franklin, this recording, which is one of her greats and truly unique. So David Ritz, we hear in this recording from the early 70s that gospel sound in its purest form from Aretha Franklin. What point did her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, knew what he had on his hands in her talent?
Early on, I mean, she was a child prodigy and became a star in the world of gospel. And also it's important to recall that she was a star during the golden age of gospel. In the golden age of gospel, you had singers who could really sing with operatic chops. And so for a child to take her place and to get this sort of national reputation during that time was really something. And so she is a product of the golden age of gospel, and of course the irony is that her dad, who encouraged her, she would open for him. I mean, you know, he had his traveling religious services that went all over the country, and she would play before he would preach. But the irony is, it was extremely unusual for that. He was a progressive. He was an intellectual who rejected this sort of notion that gospel singers can't sing pop or R&B or blues or jazz. He was a jazz fan and would have jazz and would have great jazz musicians like Art Tatum and Oscar Peterson and blues singers like B.B. King over to the Franklin home.
Well, and by that time, hadn't Sam Cooke left the Soul Stirrers and he was out on his secular career?
Yeah, and he had a big influence on her as well. But I think that even if Sam Cooke hadn't gone pop, C.L. Franklin or Aretha's dad would have encouraged her to broaden and to go out into the world of secular music. And the other interesting thing, it always is least interesting to me, is that, you know, when she's 18 is when she gets her recording contract, and that's a time when Motown had begun in Detroit, but her dad isn't interested in Motown because that's just at that point a Detroit company, and he goes to New York and he gets her contract with Columbia, which is the biggest recording company in the country.
And she's still a teenager then, right?
18.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the recording company of Duke Ellington and Mahalia Jackson and Miles Davis and Barbra Streisand and Johnny Mathis. So it's her journey is very aspirational, I mean, and her dad was very aspirational. I mean, they had big plans.
And David, I know you got to go soon, so I kind of want to jump ahead to after she leaves Columbia. She signs with Atlantic, and Atlantic had been doing a number of their recordings at the Stax Studios in Memphis, the city where Aretha was actually born. And so the falling out leads to Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And what happens to her sound when she arrives at Muscle Shoals Fame Studios?
Well, in short, her producer, Jerry Wexler, understands her and understands that she is primarily a gospel R&B vocalist. So he puts her on the piano, you know, which is her anchor. I mean, she's a great piano player as well as being this incredible vocalist. He puts her on the piano, but even beyond putting her on the piano and giving her R&B material, he actually has her produce this material. I mean, if you take Respect, for example, I mean, you know, just was originally a hit for Otis. I mean, she deconstructs, reconstructs, and reinvents the song. She has a breakdown that's not in the original song. And given the intensity with which she sings the thing, it becomes an anthem. I mean, she infuses the song with all sorts of subtext. And so that Jerry opens up the door for her and encourages her to be who she is, and which was, I think, ultimately a musical visionary.
David Ritz, thank you so much for being with us and talking about Aretha Franklin's legacy and your experience of working with her for these two books, Aretha From These Roots in 1999 and Respect, The Life of Aretha Franklin from 2014. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And let's head to a very short break. Then we'll take listener calls with another beautiful recording, Softer Side of Aretha Franklin. Tear Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We remember Aretha back in just 1 minute. Remember the great Aretha Franklin, who passed away this morning at the age of 76. We're playing her incredible recordings, hearing that voice again and again this hour, as if we needed to be reminded of the giant she is in American music and her influence. And when it comes to her influence, we open up the phones to hear from you, your memories of Aretha Franklin, the soundtrack that she's provided throughout your life. Also, if you're someone who ever worked with her, who knew Aretha. Here in Southern California, so many people had that opportunity in the music business. I'd like to hear from you at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. It's our pleasure to be joined now by the Reverend Robert Smith, Jr., the pastor and CEO of New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan, the church in which Aretha Franklin grew up, that her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, pastored for many years. Reverend Smith, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for being concerned and taking the time to reach out to us so that your audience can share with us in our time of grief and sorrow.
Well, of course, here in Southern California, she's as beloved as in her hometown of Detroit. Share with us how your church community is dealing with Aretha Franklin's passing.
Well, everybody's sad but glad. Sad that we lost her, but happy that heaven has now gained her. And, of course, she's taken over the choir absolutely now. I'm sure she's going to be the lead soloist for a while there.
Share with us the influence that she had on Detroit over the years. And your father was such an influential figure first, and then young Aretha extending that influence. What was it like for the city of Detroit?
Well, you know, her father led one of the world's largest civil rights movements here, and Aretha was always a part of the civil rights movement. Unlike many artists, she didn't have the fear of losing her popularity or a recording contract or anything because of her civil rights involvement. And so she made a great contribution to civil rights by traveling with her father, Dr. King, And we all are just touched by the fact that she blessed us in so many ways.
Pastor Smith, I also wonder about your personal friendship with Aretha Franklin. What are some of your warmest memories of the years that you've known her?
Well, I tell everybody I always recognized her as the queen, and I was in the Queen Dome, and whatever the queen said, you know, that's what I tried to do and keep her very happy.
And what were her later years like? I mean, she was, I think until about a year or so ago, continuing to perform and obviously adored. What were the last couple of years of her life like?
Well, it's like, I don't know, all of us, I guess. What we are, we can't stop being. And she wasn't a lady that sang. She was a singer that was a lady, and she could never stop. She never lost that desire to stand before audience and sing songs of Zion. And she tried to tour and would get sick and get a little strength and go back and get sick again. So it was last year was a struggle.
She's quite ill this past year.
Mm-hmm.
And what are there plans for a memorial to her yet, or is the family as they're mourning now not getting to the planning of that yet?
I'm not hearing from the family yet directly. I know that it's going to be expensive. They're going to try to have it where most of the public can get a chance to see her. I do know that much. But where and when and that kind of thing got all to be worked out.
Pastor Smith, thank you for taking this time. I know you're in great demand today, and we appreciate you sharing your memories of your friend and your congregant, Aretha Franklin. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Reverend Robert Smith, Jr., pastor and CEO of New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit, the very same church where young Aretha Franklin grew up and where her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, himself a star in religious circles, where he was pastor for so many years. Again, our phone lines are open. It's a chance for us to remember the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Share your memories if you're someone who knew her or worked with her. We're touched by her. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Victoria in the Fairfax District, good to have you with us. Your memories of Aretha.
My memories of Aretha is my father, who is James Bucky Young, who is in the Oklahoma Jazz Hall of Fame. In 79 and 80s, he was in Detroit because he was a sessionist for Leon Russell and Willie Hutch and things like that. Somehow he landed the opportunity to spend a couple of days with Aretha. He calls me on the phone, and he's like, my mom was bugging him about child support, but I could hear Aretha in the background. So he says, Aretha, this is my daughter. And she said, hey, honey. And I was like, oh, my God, I must have died when I heard Aretha Franklin's voice. But the beautiful thing about this is that he set the phone down, and he said, just listen. And so she was telling him, she said, I want you to move into B minor right quick. And he's a classically trained bassist who does blues and R&B. And she together, what they were doing, moving in and out of major, her on the piano and him on the bass, I think I was 13, my mind was so blown. But she inspired my father, and I heard this on the phone. She said, look, you have children to take care of. You need to do that. And it was an amazing, about 20-minute phone call because he just let me hear them play. And the spinners were there doing something. So they just had to get together. But over the years, she remained friends with my father. And to him, that signaled to him that he had really, really made it because of her. And that was his lifetime joy. He cried about it.
Totally understandable. Victoria, you feel like you can still almost recreate in your mind that phone call? It left such an impression?
Yes, because it never lost me. I've discussed it, several times on Facebook sometimes because I was 13, and I was, it was other children in the house, but I was musically inclined as well. So he says, listen to this, listen to this. And then he would pick the phone back up, and he said, you see how smooth she did that? And she did. And she said, no, follow me. And
she's directing.
Yeah, and they were back and forth, and it's like they were caught up in this energy. I have chill bumps right now because they were just practicing, but they were called, you know, just practicing licks, I guess. But I didn't know that she was that classical, and I guess she didn't know he was that bluesy. So he would work intricately out of classical style and then move straight into gospel with her, and they were following each other back and forth on the piano. And
oh, Victoria, what an incredible memory. Thank you for sharing that with us so much. 866-893-KPECC, the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, or you can tweet at AirTalk with your memories of Aretha Franklin, the influence you saw her having on your life. You're someone who worked with her or knew her. It's a chance to remember her during this hour of AirTalk. My pleasure to welcome to the program senior editor at Billboard, where she specializes in R&B, hip-hop, and other genres, Gail Mitchell. Gail, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, with all the artists that you covered over the years, what's your sense of the extended influence of Aretha Franklin on the performers who would follow?
I think that's immeasurable. I don't think, looking back in more recent times, contemporary times, I guess you'd say you've got a Jennifer Hudson, who I think she had tapped for her biopic earlier this year. You've got Fantasia. You've got Andra Day, you know, these big, powerful voices. And back before then, you know, she's been the icon and the mentor. You've got the Chaka Khans of the world. You've got Beyonce. You've got all these female singers that you know, have looked up to her. When American Idol became a thing, I think a lot of the songs from Aretha's catalog, everybody was trying to sing and emulate Aretha, and so her songs were used a lot, as I recall, as from some of the contestants. So it's a far-reaching, 66 decades of music and moving forward, because her catalog is just so timeless. It's just going to keep influencing people down the road.
Well, and what's your sense of the lasting influence? Because as she said in the interview that I did with her several years ago, you know, do these songs, will they stand up the test of time? And she said, yes, I think, you know, they will stand the test of time. And it seems to me that what's remarkable is there's nothing dated about her performance. There's nothing that would lead people to stop listening to it.
No, exactly. I wasn't able to see her Larry until it was in the 2000s. That was the first time I ever got to see her, and it was a big deal because she had played two nights at the Greek Theater, and it was a big deal because, as everyone knows, she didn't fly, and she didn't come out to L.A. a lot. So this had been her first concert in L.A. in I don't know however many years. And there was such electricity in the air. And she comes out and she sits down at the piano, because I think that's what a lot of people also don't talk about, is her prowess on that piano and how that came across in her music, tied in with her gospel upbringing. So it was just a treat to finally hear this person who's been such an icon, the queen or whatever, you know. After Ray Charles, I think she was the one that literally kicked the door in on the whole soul movement. So to hear her sing Respect and other songs, and just to hear, listen to her play the piano, I probably could have done that all night without listening to her voice. She was just so great on the piano as well. So it is. I remember, the first time I ever heard her, my mother was a big fan of music, and she would just try all kinds of new things. And I'm in elementary school, and she's got this album. It's Aretha. It's the first album, I believe, she did with Columbia with John Hammond. And that's when they were trying to put her in a jazz vein, which she certainly could do. But I still remember, and if you put that album on, it's called, I think it's Aretha with the Ray Bryant combo. And there's songs on there like Won't Be Long. I could put that album on now and probably sing every song on there, because that's how much my mother would rag it out. And then, you know, she was just an influence in our house in terms of my mother musically. And I think everybody black at the time had to have had an Amazing Grace album in their collection, and also Young, Gifted, and Black. So, I mean, truly someone, and it wasn't just soul. It was jazz, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
There was blues, Spirit in the Dark. There was, you know, as you recall, who else could have the fierceness and the fearlessness to sub for a great opera singer like Pavarotti at the last minute and sing opera? You know, I don't think you mean, I mean, hip hop.
Yeah.
Lauryn Hill producing A Rose Is Still a Rose. I mean, this.
Yeah, she could do everything. Gail, please hang on. We're going to continue on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC as we pay tribute to Aretha Franklin, who passed away earlier today. Much more music and listener memories of Aretha coming up. More to come on Aretha Franklin on Air Talk right after a live update from Suzanne Watley. The rawness she brings to every recorded performance, Aretha Franklin, who we celebrate today as she passed earlier this morning, died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 76. Every performance so of the moment and powerful, and we're hearing examples of that from ballads to up-tempo pieces and gospel as well. I welcome your calls. If you're a musician, a singer, you've been influenced by Aretha Franklin, how couldn't you? We'd love to hear in what ways at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. It's time for us all to remember her together. Anthony in Burbank, your thoughts on Aretha.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Okay?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Just wanted to say this is an amazing artist that really, the likes of which we won't see. It's literally like a hole in the world, like John Lennon. I'm a piano player, and I make a living producing music, and I also teach songwriting at USC. And very often when I'm talking with my students, I will use Aretha Franklin or David Bowie, a huge name, not because they're famous, but because of the quality of their work and the reach of their experience. As your other guest said, when Aretha played the piano, that was indicative to the rest of the band of how the arrangement of the song would go. She wasn't just a singer who showed up like a young singer might today on American Idol, being told what to do by a group of producers and directors and musical directors. That was all her. When she played the piano, her left hand dictated the bass and the groove to the drummer. You can hear Keith Richards talk about this when he did, they re-recorded a Rolling Stones song, and he was blown away by what she brought. It's just so easy to kind of pigeonhole a gospel pop singer in this one place. But what she does when she performs, as you've been saying, whether it's an up-tempo song or a ballad, her interpretation of the song Somewhere from West Side Story, it's unbelievable that she can make us feel something new about that song, considering we've heard the most amazing singers sing it in the traditional Broadway version. So very often I'll say to my students, they'll say, well, you know, I really want to try to emulate like Nicki Minaj. I cannot say in that classroom, you know, you're making a mistake. I cannot do that because I would be belittling their choice up to that point. So all I have to do is I have to play an Aretha Franklin song. All I have to do is play a Beatles song and give them an understanding of what actual excellence is when creating your art. You don't have to worry about saying, well, you know, someone should do their songwriting homework, or they should worry more about their singing than the clothes that they wear or the pictures of themselves that they put on their album. You don't have to say it because Aretha just does it with just her voice. And I just really wanted to represent musicians, you know, of course, across the world, but in Los Angeles, we all strive for that kind of excellence, which means rehearsal, which means working out the arrangement, which means making sure it's the right key, which means that the lyric is not just a bunch of throwaway words because no one really listens to lyrics anymore anyway. No, it actually is excellence. And that's why the songs that come and go really quick nowadays come up and down, is because that level of craft, the art and science of making music, is not present today. It's not about, oh, in the old days, you know, I don't want to sound like my father. Rock and roll. This is, you know, all people have opinions about music, but yeah, the craft of it is what she really brings. And that is what I hope will be her legacy.
Hey, preach it, Anthony. Beautifully said. You laid it out so well. And for me, you know, as you're talking about this, I was thinking about the way that she rolls into and out of the lyric. It's so unpredictable. Unless you've heard the song before and you know where she's going, you know how she's going to attack the particular note, or the word is going to be elongated or just hit quickly. You don't know. When you hear the first time, it is so unpredictable, as she is so in that moment. And that kind of musicianship, that kind of creativity, that sort of talent is incredibly rare. That's, to me, why she's incomparable. Anthony, I appreciate it very much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Paul in Culver City, you grew up in the Detroit area, is that right? Share with us your sense of her influence there.
Well, that's the thing. We can talk about her influence from a musical perspective, but there's also a social and cultural and political impact that she had too, because at the time, black artists weren't given their due. But she, like James Brown with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and Respect, that did a lot for us in our culture as black people. And we flocked to the television whenever they performed. And that last caller was exactly right. The true essence of writers, singer writers today is almost lacking. It is lacking. And I wish that many of today's artists, like Mike Tyson, studied boxing. Tiger Woods studied golf. I wish a lot of today's artists and singers would study the past, because it would help them with the future. But the cultural influence is just as important as her musical influence. And last but not least, I did watch her perform here in L.A. about 4 years ago. And I went into the concert just like kind of so-so. But by the time I left, I was thoroughly impressed, because I knew that the way she went from R&B to pop to gospel seamlessly was incredible. And I was witnessing and watching a true singer performer.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much. Beautifully said. Really appreciate you sharing your thoughts. Thank you so much for that. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, as we remember Aretha Franklin, who passed away earlier today. Let's listen to some more of her music before we take more calls. Do Right Woman, Do Right Man.
Take me to heart, and I'll always love you. And nobody can make me do wrong. Take me for granted, temptation strong. A woman's only human. You should understand. She's not just a plaything. She's flesh and blood, just like her man. If you want to
more to come on Aretha Franklin's Legacy on Air Talk on KPCC back in 1 minute. More than two decades into her career, she has one of her biggest hits in the 80s with Freeway of Love. We remember Aretha Franklin today on Air Talk, our entire hour devoted to her highly diverse music, her remarkable voice, her talent, first nurtured by her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin. And Aretha arrives in the musical world, one of the most influential figures of all time. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPECC. Kirsten in Santa Barbara, your thoughts on Aretha Franklin's legacy.
Oh, boy, I'm emotional, Larry. I just want to thank you for opening this up as a forum today because I feel like we're going to church here.
Yeah, I could not do it. So Kirsten, what does Aretha Franklin mean to you?
Well, I started hearing her songs as a kid, and I actually did get a record deal and ran that whole gamut, and you know, over the years, and you know, decided to go into different industries after a while because I kind of didn't want to make a living that way anymore. But one of the songs I recorded was an a cappella song called Prayer. And it really, you know, when I was 20, I was singing on a gospel stage with Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. as a skinny little white girl going, hey, I can tap Aretha, you know, I can channel that. And I can believe that I can touch my soul and anybody else's in the way that she did just because she inspired that.
Kirsten, I think we lost you, but thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about Aretha Franklin. Siobhan in Inglewood. Siobhan, what does Aretha Franklin mean to you?
It's Shavaz with two Z's.
Oh, Shavaz. I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
Well, no problem. Well, I grew up in the hip-hop world, and, you know, hip-hop gets a bad rap for sampling, for taking the sounds of artists of the past, when, in fact, hip-hop... The idea of sampling is actually paying homage to not only the artist but to the sound. And as a listener, consumer, and artist, oftentimes I would hear these sounds or hear an artist and or hear a sound from a song or a sample, and I want to know where that sound or where that, you know, where they got that idea and where it came from. So I would look and find, you know, the information, the artist, and then I would go to the record store and Franklin. And, you know, and not only what, you know, is it something, you know, to mention all her commercial hits, the songs that everyone knows about, but one thing when it comes to sampling, when it comes to operating in the hip-hop world and being that surgeon, you're also looking for those songs that aren't as popular. So even though we know all these songs about Aretha Franklin, hip-hop artists, oftentimes we have the music that people don't know about. And so as a result of that, I am a forever fan of Aretha Franklin, and so were my kids and their kids.
Hey, Shavaz, thanks so much. Love to hear your memory of her, and also, you know, talk about music today, hip-hop and the paying homage. Because we're talking earlier about artists today sometimes don't look back, don't have that historic sense, and it's great to hear how you definitely have that. Shavaz joining us from Inglewood, 866-893-KPECC. As we remember Aretha Franklin, Connie in West Hollywood said in high school, I remember listening to Respect. I was in the car and wanted to get up and dance, she said. I'm 65 today, and every time I hear her, I just want to move. I want to dance. That's Connie in West Hollywood. And you can share your memories of Aretha Franklin on our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Yvette writes on the page, with gratitude for Aretha, there was no one else who can get a room full of women from 8 to 80 to run en masse to the dance floor for tens of millions of weddings and strut and wag their fingers at every man in the room, daring them to come forward with smiles and power and bring tears to a president as he watches you sing, and lend your power without reservation to people who have no voice. Rest in peace. That's Yvette and her posting about Aretha Franklin. You know, you mentioned there, Yvette, about President Obama. Let's go back to the 2009 inauguration and this performance by Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin, the 2009 inaugural, this entire hour paying tribute to the music, the legacy of the one and only Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. You're listening to Air Talk on KPECC. We leave you with this.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, helping businesses improve their bottom line with solar water heating. The system preheats your water using the strength of the sun. It works with your existing natural gas water heater to warm your water in a reliable and efficient way. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover up to 80% of the system's cost. With these rebates, heating water with the sun could be a sound investment. It's the strength of the sun in your business. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, whether you're listening on the KPCC app or at 89.3 or online at kpecc.org. A horse walks into a courtroom and files a lawsuit. Well, sort of like that. That's what's happened in Oregon, where a lawsuit has been filed on behalf of a horse who was allegedly abused. Should animals have those kinds of rights, a state of personhood, able to file a lawsuit? That issue is playing out in Oregon. We'll talk about it later this hour. But first, Nearly 350 newspapers from coast to coast have editorialized today in a coordinated effort to counter President Trump's criticism of news media and his attacks on what he calls fake news. The editorials, written by the individual editorial boards of those newspapers across the country, but there are some notable exceptions. The Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, a number of other major papers have chosen not to do those editorials today, despite all of them at various points over the past year editorializing against the president's criticism of news media. With us to talk about the effort and why some papers are choosing to participate and why others not is Dan Shelley, executive director of the Radio Television Digital News Association, who joined with the Boston Globe's originated coordinated series of editorials. Mr. Shelley, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So share with us what the idea of this is. What is the hope in 300-some newspapers collectively doing it same day?
Well, we joined. We're an organization representing thousands of digital and broadcast journalists across the country, and we joined in support of the Boston Globe's effort to, A, amplify it, and, B, to craft individual messages in local TV and radio newscasts, editorials, and on digital platforms, not so much to attack the president, not to lash out at this fake news mantra that he is so accustomed to using, but really to use as an opportunity for our members, the local radio, television, and digital journalists around the country, to send a positive message about why what they do is so important to the local communities they serve.
Well, and are you concerned that this further puts newspapers as set up in opposition to President Trump by doing this, as opposed to just, you know, doing the job, being excellent, reporting fairly, and you know, going about your business, not directly responding?
Well, some have to this specific campaign that the best approach for journalists at this point would be not to participate in this attempt or this effort, but rather just to keep your head down and do great journalism. And I have often said that the only antidote to attacks on journalism is more and better journalism. But I think we have to do not only that, because as opinion polls are consistently showing now, significant percentages of the American population are buying into this notion that we knowingly report false information, that we're not here to serve the public, that we are, in fact, the enemy of the people. And I think we need to speak up in a positive way and reinforce to our audiences around the country that, you know, we as local journalists live in the same community you do. We attend the same houses of worship in many cases. Our kids go to the same schools. When we ask tough questions of local elected and other public officials, we're not doing that to create controversy. We're doing that because you can't be at that city council meeting or you can't be at that school board meeting. And so we are to keep you informed.
We're talking with Dan Shelley, executive director of the Radio Television Digital News Association. They took part in the Boston Globe's coordinated series of editorials, as did nearly 350 other news organizations. Also with us, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, which did not participate in today's coordinated day of editorials about news media. However, the Chronicle, like just about every paper in the country, I think, has editorialized on this issue in the past. John Diaz, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for having me on.
Why did you decide not to do an editorial along these lines today?
Well, Larry, as you mentioned, first of all, let me make very clear, we have been, the Chronicle takes second to no one in terms of our critique of Trump's attacks on the free press and what that means for our democracy. However, a couple reasons. One, I think an editorial board needs to be independent, and that answering the call to join in a groupthink way, no matter how noble the cause, really undermines that independence we have. There's a perception out there, and a perception that that Donald Trump is eager to feed that somehow the news media are a monolith. we're not a monolith. We're, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of independent voices. And I just think, you know, we're going to continue to talk about Donald Trump, not just in terms of his rhetoric of calling us enemies of the American people, scum, and everything else that he calls, but also some very tangible ways to undermine the free press, things like tariffs on newsprint, which is really hurting a lot of small papers, his threat to prosecute journalists who print classified information, his assaults on the business interests of like CNN and the Washington Post. There are myriad ways that we're concerned about this administration, but I just don't think a newspaper editorial board should be following anyone anytime. We need to make our own independent judgments.
What would you say to those who are critical of some American media for the sort of emotional tone of the coverage they've done of the Trump administration, and not just that they've gone after false claims or attempted to look skeptically or critically at the administration's proposals, but that there is a kind of a emotional tone to much of the coverage in highly regarded major American news media, and that this has created an even bigger rift between many Republicans and mainstream media. What's your response to that criticism?
Well, I think certainly the president, from the time he was a candidate, has been trying to whip into this us against them mentality. I think in terms of the substantive reporting of the Trump administration, particularly when you look at the major newspapers that are national papers that are covering them, whether it's New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, have done a superb job of reporting. In fact, it's in some ways they have a newspaper war going on in terms of aggressively and I think rightly serving their watchdog role. I think you have to separate that from what you see on cable news, where there really is a lot of emotion. There's a lot of punditry, a lot of talking heads. And unfortunately, a lot of people see that and think of that as, you know, the media, as if we were a monolith. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. And I think this whole idea, even though I absolutely agree with the Washington or the Boston Globe's position on this, I certainly respect Dan and others who have decided to join this campaign. But I think it's counterproductive. I think there's going to be pushback and blowback. And if you read the column that we posted yesterday and what I predicted that Trump's response would be, I mean, almost in some of the exact words, collusion, all capital letters. And I don't know that. I don't know that that has as much power as us finding opportunities, as we have repeatedly, when the president does something that is undermining press freedom, that we call it out.
We're talking with the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, which chose not to take part in today's coordinated effort for editorials in newspapers that defend American journalism and that are critical of the kinds of attacks on particular news organizations that President Trump has made in his tweets as well as in his spoken comments. Nicholas Goldberg, who is the editor of the LA Times editorial pages, wrote a piece in today's paper explaining the LA Times decision to also not take part in the coordinated effort. He wrote about all the editorials over the past year plus that the Times has published that have been critical of President Trump and his comments about news media. And then Nicholas writes, the Los Angeles Times editorial board does not speak for the New York Times or for the Boston Globe or the Chicago Tribune or the Denver Post. We share certain opinions with those newspapers. We disagree on other things. Even when we do agree with another editorial page, we reach our own decisions and positions after careful consultation and deliberation among ourselves, and then we write our own editorials. We would not want to leave the impression that we take our lead from others or that we engage in groupthink. The president himself already treats the media as a cabal, enemies of the people, he has called us, suggesting over and over that we're in cahoots to do damage to the country. The idea of joining together to protest him seems almost to encourage that kind of conspiracy thinking by the president and his loyalists. Why give them ammunition to scream about collusion? That's in part from the column today by Nicholas Goldberg, editor of the editorial pages of the Los Angeles Times. I'd like to hear your thoughts as an AirTalk listener. Do you think that the newspapers that participated have done the right thing or making a strong showing, and that in this sort of unification, albeit with individual editorial board voices, that that's an effective way of speaking back in defense of news media? Or do you think, as the Los Angeles Times editorial board, the San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, and some other publications, that that is not the best approach? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, KPCC.org. Dan Shelley, executive director of the Radio TV Digital News Association, which did take part, what do you see as the best possible outcome from the effort?
My hope is that, and by the way, I share a lot of the same views as the Chronicle with respect to the best ways to attack or fight back. I don't want to. I misspoke when I said attack. But fight back against these attacks on the free press. I respectfully disagree, however, that this is going to have a boomerang effect. I think if you take the approach, if news organizations take the approach that we have suggested, not mandated, but suggested, that this is an opportunity not to attack the president, not to attack his supporters, but to explain to the news-consuming public how we do what we do and why we do it, and that the stories we cover often serve as catalysts for positive change, I think it will make a significant difference. And it, my hope is that there will be, over time, a return of trust that and esteem in which the public holds the news media in the U.S.
Let's talk with Quay in Pasadena. Quay, your opinion on this coordinated effort?
Yeah, I think it's a big mistake because it gives the president more ammunition to claim conspiracy theories against him.
All right. So you think it'll backfire. Appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, KPCC.org. I was wondering, Dan, if you've had a chance to read many of the editorials that are part of the effort today. And what are your thoughts about the breadth of the points that they've made?
Generally positive. However, I think some of the opinion pieces and editorials that I've read from newspapers around the country have gone down the wrong road, and I say that respectfully. They have every right to express their opinions, as every American does, in that they have made this about the president and his attacks. This should be, in our view, and this is what we have encouraged but not mandated our members to do, is to flip this into a positive conversation about the contributions of journalism to local communities around the country.
Let me just share one. I don't know whether you're referring to this, but this one struck me. AP excerpted this from the Des Moines Register in Iowa. The true enemies of the people and democracy are those who try to suffocate truth by vilifying and demonizing the messenger. That to me is sort of close to criticizing a free expression, even as it attacks the work that newspapers and other journalistic organizations are doing. And I'm wondering, are you comfortable with a statement like that, Dan Shelley?
I respect that point of view. I'm not necessarily prepared to ascribe to it because I believe that America works best with a diversity of voices and points of view. Briefly to get back to an earlier point about the conflation of opinion media and what I call real journalism, which you see on cable channels and in other places, I think that's a very salient point for this conversation. I think news organizations, and cable in particular, who purport to be news organizations, need to do a much better job of identifying the difference between a panelist or a guest who is offering analysis and opinion versus a guest or a panelist who is contributing real journalism to the discourse.
All right. I want to thank you, Dan Shelley, Radio TV Digital News Association, John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Frank in Pasadena called to say news media really created this monster by covering Trump in a way that isn't truly neutral. Also, I want to correct my misstatement earlier. The New York Times did join in the effort. The Washington Post didn't take part. The New York Times did editorialize on this subject as part of the coordinated effort today. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, should animals have personhood when it comes to the ability to have a lawsuit filed on the animal's behalf? Comes from a case in Oregon about a horse allegedly mistreated. We'll talk about it in 1 minute. An 8-year-old American quarter horse who's named Justice has had a lawsuit filed on his behalf. Justice suffered by being underfed, left outside during the winter months, and at a veterinarian's exam last year, the horse was about 300 pounds underweight, skin and coat in terrible condition. So now a lawsuit has been filed on behalf of the horse. The question is, does a horse have legal standing in that way? Joining us is an attorney who specializes in animal law litigation, Matthew Liebman. He's with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, a nonprofit group suing on behalf of Justice, the horse. Matthew Liebman, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Is there a precedent for an animal being a plaintiff in a lawsuit like this?
Well, so this case weaves together two pretty well-established and uncontroversial legal principles. The first is that animals are properly considered the victims when someone violates the animal cruelty laws, and there is case law establishing that point from the Oregon Supreme Court. And the second principle is that victims of crimes have a right to sue their abusers in civil court to recover damages for their pain and suffering. And the Oregon Supreme Court has recognized that principle as well. They haven't yet recognized that those two threads go together and that as victims of crimes, animals have a right to civil recovery. But this is a logical extension of the combination of those two well-established legal principles.
And at what point will a judge weigh in as to whether this lawsuit can proceed?
Well, there was a motion to dismiss the case filed yesterday by the defendant. So we will oppose that, and then the court will presumably set a hearing on that. So I would expect a decision at this stage within the next few months, although I think it's likely that the case will live on beyond that. I think whoever loses is likely to appeal. So I think this could be a long fought out process.
What made you decide that this particular case and filing this civil lawsuit against Justice's previous owner is the good test case to combine those two principles you described?
Well, as you mentioned at the top there, the facts here are quite egregious. Justice was horrifically neglected and suffered severe injuries that will really require medical treatment for the rest of his life. If it had just been him being underweight and he was fed back to health, he wouldn't have ongoing damages of the kind that he does suffer now because of the genital frostbite, which will really require lifelong care. And so because he has financial needs that go along with his suffering, and because the restitution order in the defendant's criminal case was inadequate to cover those, we thought that under the existing arrangement, Justice
didn't receive justice and needed a civil lawsuit in the same way that we provide this cause of action to human victims of crime.
We're talking with attorney Matthew Liebman. He's with the Animal Legal Defense Fund. He's filed this lawsuit on behalf of the horse Justice in Oregon court, seeking damages against Justice's former owner for neglect. Also with us, Pepperdine University School of Law professor Richard L. Cupp. He focuses on, among other things, animal law, product liability. Professor Cupp, welcome.
Thank you for letting me join you.
So what do you think are the potential obstacles to combining the two principles established in law that Mr. Liebman just mentioned, that first of all, animals can be considered victims under the law and that victims in Oregon have a right to sue for damages?
Well, there's a nuance that I think is being missed here. And let me start off by saying that I think the Animal Legal Defense Fund has done a lot of great things. And I think I agree with Mr. Liebman that this is an egregious case. This horse has gone through egregious injuries. The neglect is egregious. So we're probably on the same page to the extent of saying more needs to be done to protect animals. But I think that's what is being missed with regard to the effort to bring forward this lawsuit is the ability without a radical change to address this kind of problem in a manner that won't lead to such a what I think quite radical change in our law that we haven't seen any courts hint that they're ready to undertake. Probably what could be done in this case, what seems to be the big problem, is that the horse had ongoing injuries that after the owner was allowed to plead to a criminal charge of neglect, the horse had continuing medical needs and the owner hadn't been required to pay for those medical needs. So a more practical solution would be to say, well, first of all, maybe the prosecutor, if they could have, should have made that part of the plea deal. If that's not possible under existing Oregon law, have a statutory solution where we say an animal abuser has to be subject to payment of medical expenses for the animal, not just as long as they own the animal, but throughout the animal's life to the extent that the injuries are related to the misconduct. So there's a pretty non-radical, actually I think completely non-radical approach here, which is pro-animals, pro-animal welfare, that doesn't require throwing out the flexible concept of property that includes looking at sentient animals as a special protected form of property.
Wait, do you need a special law in the Oregon legislature? Let's say the rescue organization, the Rescue Justice, and is providing all the medical care and you know, nursing him back to some degree of health. Could they not just turn around and sue the former owner for the costs associated with that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and we'd have to look to the specifics of Oregon law. So what I want to emphasize is that question is a pretty routine question. And if the answer is yes under Oregon law, well, then there is an existing solution. If the answer is no, there's a pretty routine approach that doesn't require throwing out millennia of property law to say let's amend the legislation in Oregon to make sure that that's allowed.
But it seems here, I think one of the aims, and we'll hear from Mr. Liebman, but it seems the intent here is to really give a kind of legal personhood, obviously not saying animals are people, but under the law, that sort of standing, like humans have, to be able to bring actions and have a human be able on behalf of the animal to do that. Do you think that would be a mistake for the law to create that kind of right?
Yes, I do. And that's where this really gets radical. If you think about it, the number of animals, if this were adopted nationwide, the number of animals that could be subject to cruelty, not necessarily are, could be billions of animals, many, many more animals than human beings. And suddenly we would be saying we're changing our tort system to allow billions of new potential plaintiffs when we can address the law under theories that we already have. And if we look at the press release that the Animal Legal Defense Fund put out when they filed this lawsuit, they conclude the press release by saying existing laws still lag far behind our current understanding of animal sentience by classifying animals as property. So if the goal is to eliminate animals' property status, that is a truly radical, society-shaking change. And we have to be careful when we say property, because that can make us think of mere property, like just a thing. And the Oregon courts have been admirable in being progressive and in emphasizing that property is a very flexible concept. And quite recently, the Oregon Supreme Court has affirmed that animals are property, but they're just a very special form of property. They're if they're capable of suffering pain, they're sentient property, and they require special protections.
All right. Richard Kupp, law professor, Pepperdine University. Also with us, Matthew Liebman of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. So, Mr. Liebman, did I correctly characterize what you're hoping to accomplish with this suit?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think it is the case that the legal system characterizes, in many cases, animals as mere property, and that's largely inconsistent with what we know about them. If we take horses in particular, they are remarkably complex animals with sophisticated emotional lives. They're also surprisingly intelligent, with a capacity for social learning and cooperation, concept formation, nonverbal communication. And so to relegate another sentient being to the category of inanimate property really fails to do justice. And this fear that if we created the ability for animals to be legal subjects or legal persons, that it would flood the courts, I think reflects really a fear of too much justice and a recognition that there is widespread violation of the rights of animals. But I also think the floodgates argument is a bit misplaced in this case. This case concerns legal rights that the legislature has already established. We're talking about a cause of action that relies on there being a violation of an already existing substantive criminal law. So unless the defendant has violated a criminal animal cruelty law, an animal wouldn't have standing. And so the precedent sought here is actually quite modest, and certainly modest compared to some of the other cases that have sought to establish animal personhood.
So let me just clarify. So are you saying that the entity or individuals who adopted Justice the Horse would not have the ability to go after the former owner who pled to the neglect charges? There is no recourse currently?
Probably not, because under the animal cruelty statute, as the Oregon courts have recognized, the duty is to the animal herself or himself and not to society more generally. And so Ms. Vircher didn't owe any legal duty to Sound Equine Options. She owed a duty directly to justice. And so when she neglected him, it was his right that was violated, not the right of the rescue organization.
All right. I want to thank you both for sharing your perspectives on the case in Oregon filed by our guest, Matthew Liebman, attorney from the Animal Legal Defense Fund, seeking status in court for Justice the Horse to be able to sue for negligence in his care. Richard Kupp, Pepperdine University School of Law professor, thinks that that goes too far and that there are better ways of getting redress for justice and for his ongoing care. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with you. Such a pleasure to have you joining us. Coming up, we'll talk about how you deal with a child's aspirations for a career that might be totally impractical. How did you weigh the decision whether to put cold water on that or let the child go with a dream you think's outlandish? Back after a live update from Suzanne Whatley. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. If you're a parent of kids who've reached a certain age where they're looking to their career post-college or high school, and They have an expectation you might think is unreasonable. How do you talk with your child about that? Maybe they think they're going to be a stand-up comedian or some other kind of a performer, and you really question whether they have the temperament or even the talent for doing that. What if it's one of those needle-in-a-haystack kinds of professions, and you think they're just not quite realistic about where the odds stand? How do you deal with that? Do you at all throw cold water on the idea? Do you provide your personal opinion? Or do you just smile and nod and offer encouragement? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is licensed marriage and family therapist based here in Los Angeles and author of the Atlantic's weekly column, Dear Therapist, Lori Gottlieb. Lori, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So the prompter for this was a recent Dear Therapist letter that you received that you responded to, and it was with the example of a parent asking about an 18-year-old son's wish to become a stand-up comedian. So what's your advice in a case like this where a parent might think it's not realistic?
Right. Well, I think it's really natural for parents to worry about what's going to happen with their kids once they leave high school. And in this case, the son wants to be a stand-up comedian and is really wanting to pursue that. But the piece of the letter that was interesting was that he's also going to college. So he chose a small college where he can study performing and writing and also do stand-up comedy. And I felt like the kid really had his head on straight, that he himself was giving himself a backup plan. And so I think sometimes we need to step back and say, what's the other side of this? What are the things that my kid is doing that is showing maturity?
Now, in some cases, you know it's really impossible. You cite the example of, you know, a kid who in high school says, I'm going to be an NBA player and, you know, doesn't play college basketball as a starter on the varsity. The kid who thinks she's going to be a concert pianist and just, you know, doesn't have that kind of extraordinarily high level talent. So in a case like that, where it's just clearly not going to happen, how do you think a parent should approach it?
I think it's important to balance encouraging your child's passions with a dose of reality. So you can present them with both sides of it. In the case of an NBA player, you know, you can say, why don't you do some research and see how many people at 18 who have never played basketball before make it to the NBA, and let them, you know, do their own research on that. Or same with being a concert pianist. You know, are these things impossible? You know, they're improbable. But again, we have to remember that it's not our life to live. It's our kids' lives. So we can offer them our wisdom and insight and let them take it from there. And if they fail, they will learn a lot from that experience.
Now, if your kid is independent financially, that's one thing. But typically, that's not going to be the case. And so there's going to be some degree of financial support or living situation that's provided. Does that alter the situation if the parent is, in a sense, investing in something they think is a lark?
Oh, absolutely. So just as you're going to give your kid freedom to explore what they want to explore, you have the freedom to set your own parameters on how much financial support you want to give to that. I get so many letters in the Dear Therapist column of parents saying, my kid is still living with me and, you know, she's 28 years old and I don't want this situation. And my response is, well, why do you have that situation if you don't want it? You can set boundaries and you can say, here, this is how much I'm willing to support your dream of doing this, you know, this job that maybe doesn't pay your expenses yet. And here's where my limits are. And, you know, I can, you know, and there's lots of ways to do that. You can not support it at all. You can say after age whatever, I'm not going to support it. You can say, you know, you need to contribute this amount to it. You can say as long as you can afford your own apartment. You know, so we can, and that's not being unsupportive of your child. You can support their hopes and dreams, but also have boundaries around how much you want to invest in it.
We're talking with licensed marriage family therapist Lori Gottlieb. She's based with her practice in Los Angeles. She writes the weekly column for The Atlantic, Dear Therapist. And we're talking about how you talk with your child about what you might think is an unreasonable dream that they have professionally. I'm so pleased to have with us a man whose talent I greatly admire. Alfred Molina, the actor, joining us from La Cañada. Alfred, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Larry. I just wanted to quickly make the point that I think when it reaches a point with your child, when they're talking about a career, maybe at the end of their college education or when they've reached a point where they can start actually looking for work, they're no longer really a child. And the conversation one has with them isn't really parental anymore. It's more to do with hopefully giving them some as positive and as supportive advice as possible. In my case, for instance, my daughter, who is now a very good, very talented photographer, had a moment in her life where she thought she wanted to be an actor. And she learned very quickly that her talent didn't lie there. But had I said to her, oh, I don't think that's a good idea, darling, I think it may well have stifled any of her creative or artistic impulse, which eventually came out in photography. And I think all I did was have to say, look, whatever you want to do is fine. You know, and I think the point as parents is, as long as they don't hurt themselves, as long as we don't hurt them, as long as we try and make sure that other people don't hurt them, I think we need to let them have their dreams and have their aspirations and let them find out for themselves whether they can do these things or not. Because in the same way that we can't feel their pain, we can't really fight those battles for them.
One of the complicating things, though, I would think in your case, you have, if my son said he wanted to be an actor, I'd say, no, that's fine. Just here's some of the things to keep in mind. Almost no one makes a living at all. In the case of your daughter asking, she's living with a man who's had an extraordinary career, who's done very well as an actor on stage, in films, and television. So, I mean, is it harder for someone like you to make that case of what acting is really like for the 99%?
Well, I could tell you a very quick anecdote. I brought my daughter onto a film set once, and when she was talking about being an actor, and I said to her, well, you know, that's wonderful, darling, but there's a lot more to it. It's not just sitting in nice trailers drinking cappuccino. And she looked at me and said, yeah, well, that's what you do. That was her only experience. But I think as she was doing school plays and so on, she began to realize that, you know, this wasn't really for her. But I think the real point is that all we can do as parents is support that dream, support that idea. And the lady who was talking just before you took my call about, you can set certain parameters like, well, you know, I'll pay for this as long as you pay for that. I think that's all very good, but that can only be done on a kind of individual basis, you know, because obviously parents have different financial circumstances and have to behave accordingly.
Alfred Molina, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. And talking about the experience with your daughter. So good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Alfred Molina with us on Air Talk. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Nena in Pasadena said, I own an academic coaching company. I think no matter what kids study in college, they end up a very different place from where they started. I think it's important to give them that guidance and let them explore what they want. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I think I've shared several times on air about when I was thinking about going into radio and I visited LA radio stations. I almost uniformly had people tell me what a terrible profession it is to get into and how you'll never make any money unless you're just the tiny, you know, 0.1% to make huge money and everyone else in radio makes nothing and you have to move around the country and never have a place you can call home for any period of time. And that was the kind of advice I was given, was stay away from this. And yet I couldn't. And I'm so happy that I pursued it, despite the fact it might not have been a strictly logical decision. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page. How do you talk with your child when they're, say, in high school and express a career path they think is best for them that you think is misguided or completely unrealistic? We'll be back in 1 minute. In case you joined us late today, I just wanted to let you know our first hour was totally devoted to remembering the great Aretha Franklin. We played a lot of her music, talked with listeners, talked with her biographer, wrote two books on Aretha Franklin, one with Aretha, and then an unauthorized biography years later, himself, David Ritz. So we invite you to hear that. It'll be posted on our AirTalk page coming up a little bit later this afternoon. We also spoke with the pastor of Aretha Franklin's church, the very same church that her father had pastored many years ago. Right now, our focus is on how you talk with your adult child or near adult child about a professional dream they have that you think is just way out of reach or nonsensical. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jesse and Marina Del Rey, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to say, when I first, I'm a couple years out of college now, and I had convinced myself when I first graduated that I was going to be a famous screenwriter instantly, obviously. And my parents, who work in entertainment, I was lucky enough to have them be very clear-headed and sit me down and say, Jess, do you want to write, be a writer because you love writing, or do you want it because you want this flashy celebrity life? And so I got, like, a regular job.
Jess, are you there? I guess we lost you. Well, we'll have to wait for the end of that story. 866-893-KPCC. Are you a writer now or not? You're leaving us with a cliffhanger. Let's talk next with Jenia in Fullerton. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, I am an actor in Southern California, but I'm also a teaching artist. And this is a topic that speaks very deeply to my heart, because the truth is, I mean, I was lucky enough to grow up in the arts and go to school. I have a college degree in musical theater. And my friends that have gone through that degree program and have moved on forward, not many of them have continued in the arts. But the training that they received and the things that they have learned through the arts have sent them in different directions that have been amazing for them and have really changed their lives for the better. And there is a communicative thing that you learn, a collaboration spirit that you learn when you're in the arts that can translate to anything.
Well, and I think it's a great point you're raising, and I would argue it's not even necessarily in the arts, that if you're studying something you really love, that you really see yourself doing, even if you don't end up doing that necessarily, it can be life-changing just in studying it. Lori Gottlieb, you want to speak about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to let kids experiment, because so much of what I hear both in the therapy room and even people who write into the Dear Therapist column is they don't say, I regret that I tried. They say, I regret that I didn't try. And so, if you want your kid to learn something about him or herself and to really have that experience, let them try becoming a chef or becoming a screenwriter or starting a company or working in the art world. And if they're really passionate about it, they're going to be willing to make those sacrifices that they'll have to make. And, the other side of it, though, is what your caller is saying, is that they'll often discover something that they're even more passionate about. And that's the time to let them experiment. You don't want them to later say, I wonder what would have happened if I had tried that.
Yeah, my degree's in psychology. I was going to go into your line of work, and I realized it wasn't for me professionally. But because I was so interested in psychology and was able to immerse myself in it in college, it was invaluable. I wouldn't change that at all. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Barbara in Sun Valley, welcome. Barbara, you there?
I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am. My son majored in guitar. Not only that, he went to an extremely expensive art school, and it was a struggle because it was a lot of student loans, but it was his passion. When he got into college, he quickly found out that he can minor in technology, which he did, He got out of school. He had a good job waiting for him in the technology field, but every weekend he still plays gigs. At the same time, two of his very good friends in high school wanted to major in music, and the parents said absolutely not. Neither one of the boys finished college.
Wow, Barbara, thank you for sharing the tale of two families. Thanks very much. Natalie, our producer on Air Talk, said, my father's an artist. When I was five, I told him I wanted to be an artist. He told me I'd never make any money at it. I should choose something else. So I did, Natalie says. Radio, of course, and hopefully it's a little more secure. I don't know, though, Natalie. We'll have to see. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You're very secure with us, so and I'm glad you're enjoying it. Michael in Long Beach says, my 19-year-old son wanted to be a rap producer. I explained to him the music industry is rough, but I didn't tell him not to pursue it. Gave up on the dream himself. Lori Gottlieb, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's probably what's going to happen, right? Is that the adult child is going to figure out it's not what she or he thought it would be.
Right, and that's a fantastic experience to have, is to see for yourself. Because if somebody else tells you that it's not going to be what you think it is, you're not going to know. You might doubt that, and later on you might say, I wish that I had tried it because maybe it would have been different. But if you actually do it and it's not what it's cracked up to be, then you feel very much at peace with doing something else. And again, probably something else that you like a lot more.
Bill in the San Gabriel Valley writes on the page, in Asian families, kids are expected to do what their parents want them to do. Acceptable majors include pre-med, pre-law, engineering, accounting. The problem is you can end up working in something you hate because your parents made you do it. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Pippi writes, I tell all the kids in my family to have a fallback profession while pursuing what they love. Like it or not, employers like to hire people who already have a job, whether it's related to their dream job or not. And Gwen writes, right at the peak of the recession, I chose to major in art history, which was what I'd wanted to major in my whole life. I never worked in the arts after graduation, but studying something that I was engaged in and enjoyed meant I got good grades, made good connections. I don't regret it. I've been employed since the day I graduated. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Gordon in Beverly Hills, quickly, how have you dressed this in your family?
Hi, Larry. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
I have a daughter who's about to turn 29, and all through her education, I've paid for it. She went to 3 different colleges. She went to the Atlantic Theater Company, and she went to a cosmetology school. And so for a while, that was going to be her career. And now she wants to go to the Groundlings and take classes there. So my older daughter, who's 32, says to me, why are you paying for her? She has a job.
And quickly, what's your response to that?
Well, I kind of feel I want to help her, you know, get to where she needs to go. And, you know, if she has difficulty, you know, paying for it, I will help.
You want her to be able to pursue it, Gordon. I appreciate it very much. Lori Gottlieb, who writes the Dear Therapist weekly column for The Atlantic and is a licensed MFCC, thanks for joining us. Have a great afternoon.